charge we're not sure about.
Okay, bootstrapping another episode of the In Tech We Trust podcast. I believe it's episode number 88. I'm Nigel Poulton and I'm joined... Well, I'm going to introduce Gabriel first because we haven't had you for a couple of weeks, Gabriel.
Hey, hey, hey.
Where have you been?
Yeah, now.
Woo!
Well, believe it or not, I just went back and looked at my calendar. I have yet to spend a week at home where I did not fly since the start of the year. It looks like July, 4th of July week will be a week where we shut down. It'll be the first time I've not flown anywhere since the start of 2016.
Congratulations. That is tragic. Oh, that's all. Well, not tragic. That's awful. That's brutal.
You know, it's not always horrible. The challenge tends to be that, you know, when we record, for me, it's usually 3 o'clock Pacific time, and it's like I'm either catching a plane or I'm off coming from a meeting or I'm in my car. And, you know, obviously the longstanding joke has been my sound quality sucks. And, you know, I definitely want to move past that. But, you know, it's just I'm just buried in work with my new role. And that's, you know, really what it's boiled down to is I just I'm working 24/7, it seems like.
No sweat. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm not working. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not traveling. I'm the exact opposite of Gabriel.
Which is the best. I suppose what you're doing, Mark, is the best for a certain period, but then beyond a point, yeah?
Yeah, and I'm drinking beer.
Oh, there you go. Are you doing that, Gabriel?
I'm actually not drinking beer. I'm taking a booze sabbatical for a while.
Oh, I just meant right now. I just meant at this minute. I wasn't trying to, like, understand, you know, everybody's, like, relationship with alcohol.
I'm sitting at the St. Julian Hotel in Boulder, Colorado, prepping for our big analyst day for tomorrow. So it's
hey,
a very exciting time at Solid Fire. We have all of the super analysts from around the planet and customers and all kinds of people coming out to hear all the things that we're going to announce tomorrow. So that'll be broadcast live. Shameless plug.
Gabriel, do you still call it Solid Fire rather than NetApp then?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's happening tomorrow, but by the time people hear this, it will be 4 days in the past.
Well, there we go.
So don't plug something that happens tomorrow. Plug it. Plug listening to the replay.
Go listen to the replay when it comes out in a couple days when you hear this podcast.
Yeah, there you go. Hey.
Well, last week, didn't we talk about the HPE thing, the Microsoft phone thing? And I think the Microsoft phone thing actually was pretty much hot off the press the day that we were recording. And we're like, you know what? We've not got a lot of information. This is hot off the press and what have you. And I'm about to push the button to publish it exactly 1 week later, which is shameful of me. But never mind. We're going to work on that. Anyway, how's about we hit some tech news and business news then? I'll run through what we've got from this week and we'll just take it from there. So under tech news, right, the AWS snowball is starting to appear across the world, right? Their fancy new way of getting lots of data into the AWS cloud fast. Chinese firm, I don't know how to pronounce this, WeWin, I'm going to say, starts shipping Facebook stats.
WeWin!
WeWin, yeah, subliminal. Anyway, they're shipping Facebook-style JBOF, so just a bunch of flash based on Open Compute Designs. This one's really good, right? And it's a bit of a, you know, it's like shock and awe that there's a pun in that you'll see in a second. But strategic US government and military systems apparently are still running on some proper legacy IBM kit. I really want us to talk about that one because I'm wondering whether that's a positive thing. Anyway, business news, right?
Pure announces, don't tell me we're going to agree on something again.
I know, yeah. Well, Pure announces its quarterly results, and Goldman's is lending $75 million to Nutanix, pre-IPO Nutanix, still remember. And I'm sure by the time we publish the podcast, they'll still be pre-IPO. But they're lending them at extortionate rates, and maybe we'll get into what that's about. Anyway, so that's what we've got for the week, right? I really want to talk about this US government thing, right? Because I don't really think it's a story in and of itself, but I think it's a pretty cool thing to talk about, right? So the US Government Accounting Office, I've no idea who they are, right? But they are saying that apparently there are like IBM Series 1 computer systems from the 70s still coordinating nuclear forces like ICBMs and nuclear bombers and stuff. And then the Treasury Department is doing your tax returns on a 56-year-old mainframe. Now,
which one story, is that? Does it name the mainframe?
It doesn't actually. Well, I didn't.
It's 56
pick it up.
Years old. It can only be one or two.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, right, so the story, it was a story on the Register, and it was a pretty funny story, I thought. But it paints it as in this is like a bad thing. I don't know what your take is on it, but I'm not sure I actually buy that it's a bad thing. I'm like, that's probably a good thing, right?
Yeah, the Series 1 was a great machine. It was a terrific machine that nobody knew anything about, but back in the days, all bank transactions were done by Series 1. You know, when it was used in the government, it had a lot of usage in government. They were real time systems. It was an IBM real time system at a time when, you know, it was real time systems were hard to come by. You might remember the old company Tandem.
Oh, yeah.
Tandem.
Yeah.
They built real time systems, and the idea was that, you know, they were going to build a bigger, faster thing than IBM's sort of utilitarian, Series 1. And, it sort of worked. I mean, I think Tandem became part of Compaq, eventually part of HP. It's interesting. The Series 1 machines are still running. None of those Tandem boxes. I don't think Tandem boxes are running in too many places. Okay, listeners, you know, pile on. But, and there's nothing wrong with Tandem, by the way. Tandem was a very serious company. It's just that the Series 1, it's just one of those things. It just keeps on ticking. They're very robust. They're real-time systems. I don't know what you need to launch missiles. But you probably don't need Windows 10.
Well, that's it, right? So what would we rather it be? Windows 10 running on Azure with a bunch of Java-based apps? Is that what we're saying it should be? I mean,
yeah, do we want to launch missiles from the cloud?
I don't want to change anything because it's security through obscurity, right?
Exactly.
Nobody's going to be hacking that 8-inch floppy disk.
No, exactly. Right? So they did say 8-inch floppies that can each hold 80K of data.
God, wouldn't you like the contract on those 8-inch floppies? Oh my God, who's got that? Like 3M, is 3M providing those to them? For how much do you think? Like $1,000 a floppy or something?
But you know, there's no exploits there. Right?
And you know, absolutely none, no, I bet. But as well, I thought, you know, what's the support contract? I'm assuming they would have a support contract behind something like this. What have they got, like a bunch of old age pensioners out there on like life support systems that are paid for by the US government, just keeping like the handful of people going that know actually how to support something like this?
You'll never know, Nigel. They're all black badge.
Yeah, yeah.
They probably have an extensive set of, you know, runbooks engaged that they can leverage to, you know, kind of run through those processes. I mean, it's got to be. The manual intervention required for some of this stuff has to be fairly minimal.
I mean, and it is IBM Federal Systems Division, and they've got people there doing that. And, you know, it's part of their thing. And it's like a lot of other defense stuff. I wasn't really joking. I meant black badge. There are people that work on all kinds of weird, obscure technology. And, I'm sure they don't have to wake up 90-year-olds to do the support call.
No, I'm sure. But you know what? I think the whole thing is testament to some of that old technology, yeah? I mean, I've spent a lot of my working career working in financial services in the UK, and most of the banks, like the high street banks, the retail banks, have still got mainframes at the core of what they do. And they've still got iSeries or AS400 systems as well that I think, one, yeah, it would be difficult for them to get rid of. But two, there's really just not an appetite to do it because they're so reliable, they're so secure. Effectively, I don't want to use, you know, the cheesy term bulletproof, right? But these things work, and we just don't build hardware and operating systems and, you know, I guess programming languages like Fortran and COBOL and stuff like that. We don't build stuff like that anymore. It's all kind of the consumer approach to it. You know, we'll have something new within a couple of years and, you know, we don't fix anything. We rip it and replace it. And I get that has its benefits and things like that, right? But I tell you what, you know, some of these mainframes and things, they are testament to almost a bygone era of when we did things properly. In my, you know, that's the way I see it.
But I also see it from the standpoint of, all things have kind of gone that way. The consumerist society, like, you know, the toaster you buy today isn't supposed to last 10 years the way the toaster that your grandparents was bought that lasts 50 years. In fact, interestingly enough, I go out and I always look at like garage sales and stuff like that. So if I can find like a mixer or some of the older appliances, they last forever. They have no electronic parts. They're all, you know, essentially analog devices, and they're superior in every respect. You know, anything I buy new today, it's like it's got a 3-year shelf life, and that sucks.
Do you have old phones around your house?
I do. I do have a couple old rotary phones.
No.
Same here.
I do.
I don't use them, but they're out in the garage.
No, I have them because, A, they're bulletproof. They will always work. They don't require power. It doesn't quite work for my VoIP line, but and then when my daughter becomes a teenager and I want to ground her, I'm going to make her use the rotary phone to call her friends.
Do you reckon we could string up a bunch of rotary phones and record a podcast over them at some point? Is that doable?
Oh, it's very hard, actually. There was specialized equipment made that did that, and I have one of those things out in my garage too. I'm trying to remember what they were called, and it was tough. You know, the sound quality actually of those old Western electric phones was quite good, but the hard to record.
Such a shame. Hey, speaking of no electronic parts in some of the old mixers and things that you were saying earlier, Gabriel, I'm assuming these 56-year-old mainframes and IBM Series 1 and stuff, they're proper like semiconductor based and what have you. They're not like, there's no valves and things like that in them, right?
57 years old.
I mean, can you imagine that?
You may have tubes.
No. They don't have tubes. 57 years old was this transistor. Let's see. 57. Wow. If we go back,
57. Yeah. It's tubes.
Transistors. And transistors were just coming out.
I know listeners would be able to tell.
In the late 50s, Seymour Cray at Controlled Data was developing weapons systems for the Navy. And in parallel, he developed a tube and a transistor system. And even though the transistors were a lot harder to work with at the time, they decided that was going to be the way of the future. And so they finished the contract using transistors. But that was the stuff. I mean, you didn't have integrated circuit chips in the 50s. I mean, you had discrete transistors. ICs didn't come around until the, 63, 64, something like that, maybe 62. The first integrated circuit was developed, you know, by Texas Instruments or something. You didn't have CPUs made, you know, until Intel made the 4004 or whatever back in 71, I think it was, 72. So if it was in the 50s, it was 50s era stuff, it might very well have been transistors, but that's really hard to think of.
I think that they have the Computer Museum over in Palo Alto has one on the floor that you might be able to go look at. Just Googling the image, it doesn't show it being a test tube-based system, but, you know, it's hard to tell what age of the IBM system Series 1 that they have. I would hope that maybe they were able to upgrade the system a little bit.
Well, I'm sure the Series 1s that were sold in the 70s were transistor or, you know, IC chips, but I don't know, maybe not.
These look like 70s or 60s models, and they definitely have transistor-based architecture.
Okay, so that's all interesting, right? Kind of segueing a little bit away from that, but onto something that's, I think, an interesting mix of like uber modern cloud stuff with some retro technology thrown in. So the story at the top of the show about AWS Snowballs being out there in the wild now, right? Just in case any listeners aren't aware, right? So the AWS Snowball is this kind of huge hunk of storage, 50 terabytes worth of storage, actually. And it's about the size of like a luggage trolley that you would maybe take on an airplane. Basically, if you want to get data into Amazon Web Services fast, you don't do it over the internet, right? Because that's like slow as a dog. Basically, they will ship you out this big suitcase thing that, you know what, I don't even know what's inside of it, right? 50 terabytes worth of storage, probably disk. Upload your data to it, send it back to Amazon. They upload data into AWS for you. Now, I don't know where I stand on this, right? Because the cloud is all about, like, in my opinion, right, no moving parts or, like, high-speed networks and uber-modern, uber-funky. And here they are sending out like this legacy, like huge old briefcase. You want to get your data up to us? Stick it on this and then post it back to us.
The Roach Motel.
Yeah.
Data checks in and it never checks out.
Yeah.
The largest size sneaker net vessel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I tell you what, you'd break your back carrying it.
There's a picture of a guy carrying one, and it's substantial. It's not light. I would guess that there's probably SSD disks in there just to get rid of any functional deficiency and a head shift on a spinning disk, to be honest. Lighter, less power, all of those types of things.
It would make sense. I tell you what was a nice little touch on it as well, right? If anybody, any of the listeners see a picture of it, right? So because you mail it back to them, instead of you slapping on like a mailing label with the barcode and stuff, it's got this embedded Kindle, or it looks like a Kindle. It's got like
screen,
that
yeah.
funky paper touch screen that's got the barcode and the shipping details on there for you. So you can't send it to the wrong place. But I tell you, here's a question, and it's something I don't know. The article I read didn't go into it. But from a security perspective, right, I mean, you're putting up to 50 terabytes of your company and potentially customers' data on there, and then snail mailing it back to Amazon. I'm assuming there's going to be some encryption or some...
Yeah, there's encryption on it.
There is.
It's 256-bit encryption that's on there, right? So it's end-to-end encrypted. When you get the enclosure, it's basically a secure enclosure locked to you. Then essentially you're going to place your data on there. That data is encrypted as it basically lands. And then it's shipped back, and then they decrypt it on the other end.
Cool. Interesting. All right, then. Few more details on it, right? So the thing is, right, the upfront cost to use the service at the moment in the US is $200 US. Then they charge you, because I guess, right, this works both ways. You can send your data to them on this, or they can extract it from AWS onto one of these devices and send it back to you if you want to pull it back in-house. Now, if you're doing that, it's the $200 upfront charge. 0.03 cents per gigabyte to pull the data off AWS, plus you pay any charges that you would need to get it off Glacier in the first place. And then you've got to pay for the shipping yourself as well. So, I mean, it's only my opinion, right? And I don't work for a company that would need to use something like this. But I think I'd have to be, I don't know, I'd be pretty desperate to use it. It doesn't seem cheap. It sounds pretty arcane way of doing it.
For the type of customer this is targeted at, this is not the kind of customer that's got 10 workloads running in Amazon.
No.
50 terabytes is a starter kit, and then the price point that they're putting this into is peanuts compared to most of these people. When your AWS bill is, you know, 20K, 30K, 400K a month,
yeah,
you know, whatever, you know, 10 grand it costs for you to do this and to get the data up there for a new project is well worth the time advantage, right? For the right kind of customer, this is a perfect vehicle for ingestion.
And you're not going to bark over having to pay for the shipping yourself when you bill several thousand or $100,000.
Sorry, you know, the $100 it cost me to ship the box is the least of my concerns.
Fair enough.
You know, but I mean, I can see it as like I don't think this is targeted towards the SMB or mid-tier customers. It's for people who are very advanced users of Amazon, who do have large ingestion rates that want to get data up there faster, where time value of money is much more attractive to them than you know, anything else. And the fact that they can take think about this from, you've acquired a company and you want to ingest their platform into your Amazon structure, what's easier to do? It's easy to ship these boxes over there, suck the data off that you need, and then put it into your AWS infrastructure and not even have to worry about it. And think about it from the time portion of it, but also the hand-holding, the services, all of the additional man-hours required to do something like that. I mean, anybody who's been through an acquisition has gone through just weeks and weeks of pain points. This is kind of like the swoop and scoop.
You got anything to say on it, Mark?
No, I mean, it's a very interesting use case, and you know, it solves the pig in the pipe problem. You know, you got too much data that you're trying to move through in a specified period of time. I'm trying to think through if there's a security angle or what the operations constraints might be, where someone would say, you know what, it is going to be faster to do it this way than uploading it. And oh, I know the issue. I'm sorry, it took me so long, right? a company's only got so much bandwidth, right? Yeah. And they're going to consume all their bandwidth going to the internet doing this upload of data.
And I think
that's it.
I might be wrong about this, but I think certain storage solutions on AWS throttle the ingest rate anyway. So no matter if you've got a big fat pipe, I don't think you can just push it up there at the speed of the pipe. Could be wrong on that, actually.
Think about how long it would take to push 50 terabytes up there, right?
Yeah.
Even with, an OC192, it's going to take a bit of time. This is probably a three-day turnaround.
So how long do you reckon before we get to the point where networks are good enough to do stuff like that? Or are we always going to be chasing our tails with that, do you think?
I think there will always be price structure that makes certain things more affordable.
Yeah, there's going to be network costs involved, and it's always going to be cheaper to carry something than to send it over a network if you've got enough of it.
Yeah. Especially given that the data you're pushing up is going to be encrypted in flight. That means it's going to go up raw.
Yeah.
That makes it even longer.
It just seems so retro to me. It's is it really 2016 and we're having, suitcases full of storage being sent through the post? I get it that it works and, it's a decent solution and the price point is good. It's just if I was to explain that to my kids, they'd be like, Dad, don't be stupid.
I mean, but Amazon's always had the ability to send them hardware.
They have, yeah.
That's nothing new. They're just doing it on a bigger scale.
It's a packaging exercise.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Hey, so one last story in tech news before we talk about the Pure and the Nutanix business and financial stuff, right? Chinese firm, we'll call them Winwin, right? They've started shipping this, I think it's 2U, just a bunch of flash based on open compute designs. So Facebook-style flash storage, right? It can take, I think it was 60 SSDs or 30 NVMEs. Do you think we're ever going to get to the point where this kind of, made by Chinese manufacturers, unbranded, white box, things based on the Open Compute Project, are they going to at some point, do you think, replace the kind of branded server stuff that we get today from HP and from Cisco and from Dell?
Probably not. I mean, to some degree they will, right? But the Facebook, what do I want to say, data integrity model is eventually, everything is eventually synced and things take time. These, even though it's loaded up with flash, the way Facebook does things is they're not concerned about making sure that data's written to a couple places.
Eventual consistency, you're thinking?
Eventual consistency. Right.
Just, I'm thinking that this is just it seems to me to be just raw flash that I guess you could use for anything, you know, just as a raw dumping ground, or you could have software that controls it and does RAID and things like that. See, my question was really, the background behind my question was because I personally do think that things like this might replace a lot of the branded stuff that we buy, maybe over the next 10 years or so, but it kind of goes against the grain with me in some respects that a lot of companies seem to be wanting to dull down their IT, right? They don't want to pay for highly skilled people. They want to run, as few IT people on the books as possible. Let's get kind of packaged solutions that are dead simple to do and all that, taking away the having to bolt it all together and, you don't need technical whizzes anymore. Yet on the other side of the coin, there's all this white box stuff, Open Compute Project, going to come in potentially really cheap, but it requires the skills and the developers and the people like that to be able to write software and run systems that manage it. So
let me inject with a little bit of stuff here real quick. So I think OCP is a very cool thing. I think there's a lot of value to a certain number of customers or companies out there, which is a handful. The reality is when you do, very few people can actually do that build versus buy decision and do the build part properly when it comes to enterprise type technologies at this scale. And that's like Facebook and Google and Amazon and some of these others, right? Everybody else wants to go that route, but when they actually start to investigate what it takes to do it, they quickly realize that like it's more headache than it's actually worth, right? So as cool as this box may be, this box is built for one or two customers. It's not for everybody. And it's definitely, when you start to realize, it's like, yes, I can download the software and put it on this white box server, and stuff, but now I have to deal with somebody else's supply chain and the management aspects around that. It gets amazingly complex. And then you have to start dealing with a hardware compatibility list and all the headaches with that. And then you have to start doing qualification efforts. And you things that you offload to the vendor that the vendor naturally does that you get to do, do you have the internal expertise to be able to do that? If you need 10,000 of these systems, you have where do you go to have that done? Do you have to go to Disti or do you have to go to some integrator? And then there's, you know, every step of the way, you're just adding a little bit more complexity and things that are definitely not your core competency. And as such, you're gonna screw it up, right? Or you're gonna basically spend all your time and effort, servicing this thing when you could just go out and buy something that does the same thing, and then you're handing off the headache and the support and all the other things to somebody else. And in the end, it's kind of like one of those things where which is more valuable, your time or your money?
Yeah, I guess that's kind of where I was coming from when I was blathering around earlier. I think, Facebook, it's fine to make, for Facebook to make things. This is what we use, but, you know, they've got very specific
requirements
and goals and tolerances and all kinds of stuff. And it doesn't, those things don't match up at all. I mean, you think about what Facebook needs. Why does Facebook, why would you think that, a commercial entity would use the same kinds of or have the same requirements as Facebook? Totally different. I mean, Facebook is super scale. Great. Yeah. And there's things that they need to deliver quickly. Great. And there's things they don't need to like ever deliver again. And so you might say, well, that sounds like tiering, but it's not. It's a whole different ball of wax. So one of the other interesting things about this, that I read and just reading through the article that was in the Register that talked about this is it talked about SSDs that were over 15 terabytes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, those Samsungs.
Does anybody know what the capacity of those drives is?
Well, it's 15.3 terabytes.
15.3? And have they been been out for very long?
So that's, part of the NetApp announcement just recently was that you'll be able to buy those inside a NetApp storage array. A traditional FAS array, you'll have the 15 terabyte SSD.
Oh, okay.
All right, then. So let's make a switch then to business news. The two things that we had there were both, I guess, financially related. Let's hit the Pure one first, right? Just a little bit of background here, right? So Pure announced their quarterly results. So quarterly revenue of $139 million, right? That's up 89% year-on-year for the same quarter, but it's down 7% quarter-on-quarter. So for me, right, and these are just the high-level big-picture numbers, up 89% is obviously it's a positive. I'm not saying it's good, right? Pure are quite a long way from being profitable, and I mean a long way, okay? But 89% growth year-on-year is good. However, the first ever quarterly decline, so based on the quarter before that, they're down 7%. First time they've recorded that since they IPO'd. So I don't know, maybe we'll have different opinions on this. I do know that Pure are a long, long way from being a profitable company, right? I tend to think that these numbers a positive, right? Gabriel, I know that you disagree, right?
Yeah, I would say I disagree. And I think part of it is there's a very good article on Seeking Alpha that talks about the valuation there. Many startup companies do things with non-GAAP accounting, and that's kind of that's a tricky area to work in. And I think that that's what some of the investor class or the analysts in the investor space are pointing out, is that the non-GAAP earnings are askew. And then you look at the class action lawsuits being filed about it. And, part of that is, it's a growing pain and it's being battle-hardened because that's what happens to almost everybody once they IPO. There's always somebody who's kind of butt hurt and is looking for an excuse to kind of go after them, especially when you have a miss and the stock loses 20% of its value in a single day. I would expect that to happen with any company that has the same. It wasn't like Pure was the only people that had a bad week last. Palo Alto Networks had a bad week and several others in the tech sector. But what I think they're looking for is a company with a product that's essentially a one product company right now until they actually productize that FlashRay solution. Do they have the kind of longevity that is worth investing at the valuation that the company has today?
Yeah, 20% hit. I think that's an overreaction, the 20% hit, but that's the way the market is. The market's overreacting. The market appears to be very ready to want to punish tech stocks right now.
Which is a bit harsh on Pure, right?
Well, it's what I think. I thought the 20% was way an overreaction. I mean, I understand both sides of this. Yeah, okay, so they didn't make their quarter to quarter, you know, boost, right? Okay, 7% down. It's not flat. It's a little down. People wanted to see, close to 100% year on year and growth quarter to quarter, but it's just not. As you grow and you mature as a company, it's just harder to keep doing that stuff.
And also what they're doing, though, is they're facing the challenge of having to spend a lot more money on administrative and R&D costs than they did in the past as they start to bring out this new product. And that's to be expected, and I think that the market should be able to price some of that stuff in. The market prices, if we believe the market analyst, the market prices in all of these different adjustments into the price of the stock to make sure that it's appropriate. And if... they should be taking into account some of these things, like the increase in, marketing sales costs, R&D costs, and whatnot, based on prior quarters, because it's a company that's trying to grow the business and grow market share. And as a public traded entity, you should be able to weather that storm. I mean, it's not like they're violin and they're sitting at 48 cents and being delisted. It's just they're not a hot topic stock right now, and institutional investors are very leery when it comes to that stuff, and they're the ones that buy in big chunks, and they buy and sell in big chunks. I mean, I will say one thing that's interesting, and I do this with all kinds of companies, is I go in and look at the insider trading to see what's happening, and that's usually an indicator of something, right? So you have Tiger Management that bought something like 4.2 million shares recently, and then in March, and then turned around and offloaded them on 4/4 in April in a relatively fast fashion.
Who's Tiger Management?
They own 10%.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't know who they are. Tiger Global Management LLC.
Oh, okay.
Looking at the.
So they own 10% after offloading them in April.
Beneficial owner of 10% is what they're calling their relationship, right? And so the indirect, so meaning that they, sell, they acquired 4.2 million shares on the non-open market in March. All right. And then it looks like they bought another. They bought some more shares that got them up to a total of 5.2 million, and then they turned around and sold 1.93 and 935K worth of shares.
Hmm.
So I just think that that's interesting. I don't know what that indicates. I'm completely off base. It's just, it's a layman trying to analyze something like this. And if we talk to somebody who actually did this type of stuff for a living, they'd be able to probably talk about it more affluently than I am. But it is interesting to see what happens when the institutional investors or the people that are insiders, considered insiders, what they do with their stock. On the flip side to it, they had some people that work internally that bought big chunks. So, that's a vote of confidence for the people who did, right? And so that kind of gives you sometimes a sentiment. When I worked at another company, I would always kind of like be sketched out when I saw all the corporate officers, dumping tons and tons of stock.
Oh, yeah.
Because that usually, to me, it was an indication of like, oh, all right, they know something. Something's not coming up good. No. They can't all have a mistress that requires a certain amount of revenue.
You never know. Sticking with money, right? Goldman Sachs lends Nutanix $75 million, right? At terms that give Goldman a tidy return, and I'm quoting there from marketwatch.com, so the bit... at terms that give Goldman's a tidy return. Basically saying that, look, they've loaned Nutanix this $75 million, but it's extortionate rates, which seems to suggest, right, Nutanix, I want to be careful what I say here, right, but let's just say very keen to take the money. A
9% return?
I think so, yeah. I mean, you've got to be... pretty much in need to go for something like that. And this is not that regular, I don't think, this kind of loan.
No, I don't recall seeing this, a company getting, basically a crutches loan to last while they're heading into IPO. This is very strange.
It is strange. And again, I think you were suggesting, Mark, earlier that the market, is looking to punish tech stocks and things at the moment. Just an opinion there. Okay. But also, yeah. On a similar vein, right, but not opinion, got some numbers to back this up, right? Apparently, there have only been 3 tech IPOs this year up to May. Now, to give that some context, right, I think there was 6 in the same 3 months last year, but then the 5 years prior to that, there were 15 in the same 3 months. So really not a great time for Nutanix to be IPOing if they do decide to push the button on that, because they filed for IPO must be, well, several months ago now. I don't know how many months ago, but they did. They filled out their S1 form quite a while back. But it just seems like the market is not a great market for tech IPOs again at the moment. So that makes it quite awkward for them, I guess, doesn't it? If they were, you know, looking at planning out their burn rates and everything like that, how much cash they've got, what they're going through, saying this will be a great time to IPO, then the market's like, you know what, we don't want tech company IPOs. Really puts you in an awkward position. Dare I say the position to be accepting loans from people that are going to absolutely take you to the cleaners when you need to pay back.
Yeah, not only that, but when they IPO, I mean, the use of the IPO funds, you know, a portion of that is certainly going to go to pay back Goldman.
Oh, that and sucks so for, as well.
Yeah, and so if you're an institutional investor, you know, that you're a bank that competes with Goldman or whatever, it's like, okay, this is the cost of doing business, but do you want to buy into this IPO and have, you know, that bit of it sliced off or siphoned off to help your competitor Goldman? No.
No, you don't, right? Do you?
And I think that will have the effect of lessening the value of Nutanix in the market when it goes IPO.
Yeah, because you look forward to that IPO for so long, don't you? You know, you've got shares in the company, you know, maybe you've worked there for a while, your investors are looking for an exit. It's seen as this big thing. But then to have this kind of baggage already stacking up saying, well, you know what, when that IPO does go through, you got us to pay, I think takes the edge off it a little bit, which is a shame. I think obviously Nutanix, you know, technology aside, right, the market's just not great for them. I'm kind of disappointed for them in that respect, because I like their technology. I think, you know, they're very bullish as a company as well, aren't they? They like to put themselves out there, challenge the norm, take on the big players. I think they've got pretty decent technology in my opinion as well. But it comes down to money at the end of the day.
Yeah, and they're similar to Pure in certain respects, you know, sort of the swagger and,
yeah,
you know, if there's unicorns in tech, those two companies are unicorns, Pure and Nutanix. And you kind of have to question certainly considering the way that Pure just got beat up on its last earnings, you've got to think that the IPO market for a company like Nutanix is lousy, that companies won't go for it. If they smell anything that's funny, you know, it'll be off. What happens if Nutanix never IPOs?
Yeah.
What happens, right? The IPO market could be better now than it is a year from now.
Absolutely, it could be, yeah.
Then what happens? Well, I guess maybe all the investors lose out. And, you know, at some point, if they don't IPO or something doesn't happen, they're going to run out of money because they're losing more money than they're making.
I mean, the thing is, right, IPOing, it's a big thing, like I said before, but then they're already, Nutanix here are already racking up this debt that needs to be paid back. And then once you IPO, your books are open and on your quarterly earnings calls and stuff, people start tearing you apart. It's like, where's the fun in that?
I mean, in some ways, Nutanix should be Pure's biggest cheerleader right now, trying to get people excited about Pure.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of investors look at these companies as being, you know, twin sons of different mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And if Pure stumbles or has problems or, and then say they've got a bad quarter next quarter or something that's similar and that stock gets beat down, you know, it's going to reflect on Nutanix.
Yeah, absolutely. So Pure needs to do well to give Nutanix a better IPO chance, because if Pure starts tanking, man, that IPO is just even less and
further
less
likely, and further it? Off. Right, you know, exactly. it means they can have an IPO, but they'll get a lot less per share than what they were hoping for.
Well, it'll be an interesting one to watch. It's not going to go away anytime soon, I don't think. So we'll see. Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. Gabriel, okay, Gabriel's gone. He had to leave 10 minutes ago. But Gabriel, if you're listening, it was also a pleasure. And let's wind the show out with a secret Windows phone app.
The last one in honor of Microsoft shutting down its phone business.
Hello, this is Mark Farley. and you're listening to Secret Windows Phone Apps. And today, we're going to be talking about something that's very, very secret.
I love you.
The cloaking device.
You know, like the one that Captain Kirk has, so he can take the Enterprise past all the Klingons. Or the one that Harry Potter has, so he can get away from the Dementors. Well, you know, the Windows Phone has a cloaking app. And the thing that really proves the point is that nobody knows about it. Nobody knows about the app, and almost nobody knows about the Windows Phone. That's how good the app is. It makes the Windows Phone very, very secret. So, like, when you go to a concert or a movie or something like that, and they make an announcement, please turn off your phones. You don't have to turn off your Windows Phone because it's already invisible using the cloaking app. And something else that's really cool is that there's a secret chip in every phone that identifies every Windows Phone uniquely. And this secret chip works with the cloaking app. And Microsoft has the ability to turn it off and on. And they can turn on the cloaking app to all the Windows phones, even if you don't have the app installed. And some people are very, very afraid that this is going to be like Order 66 from Star Wars, where Microsoft just turns the cloaking app on all the Windows phones in the world, making them all virtually disappear at once. But that would just be silly. Why would Microsoft want to get rid of all of their Windows phones when there are so few of them left? They're practically extinct right now. I'm going to call Steve Ballmer right now about this and find out about the disappearing Windows phones and the disappearing Los Angeles Clippers. Hello? Hello, Steve Ballmer. Please pick up. Steve Ballmer, we want to know what's happened to all the Windows phones. We thought you were going to do something grand and glorious with them, but they seem to have disappeared. Steve.